The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Copper futures are on track to settle at the highest level in over 2 years.
We're looking at commodities. Goldman Sachs out with a new call that says the asset class is moving towards a structural bull market. They actually see return over the next 12 months of 28%.
Well, it's clear that the pandemic has in some ways really put a tailwind behind what's going on in the crypto markets. One example, frankly, is when you print lots of additional fiat currency, as we have seen here in the United States with the stimulus, you know, that is inflationary in some level. And so you've seen the crypto market overall increase by about 90% this year, and gold, obviously, as another proxy for inflation, has obviously performed really well.
The Justice Department declaring war on Google. Federal prosecutors accusing Google of being a monopoly gatekeeper for the internet, accounting for close to 90% of searches in the country. They claim the tech giant has been engaging in anti-competitive tactics, paying phone manufacturers and tech companies billions to allow Google to be their default search engine.
Housing market just continues to break records. Sales were up 20.9% year over year, and that is the highest sales pace since May of 2006, according to the National Association of Realtors.
It closed down the oil industry. I would transition from the oil industry, yes. That is a big statement.
That's a
because
big statement.
I would stop.
Why would you do that?
Because the oil industry pollutes. It has to be replaced by renewable energy. And I'd stop giving to the oil industry, I'd stop giving them federal subsidies. He won't give federal subsidies to the gas, excuse me, to the solar and wind.
We actually do give it to solar and wind.
We
and that's maybe the biggest
question.
Statement in terms of business, because basically what he's saying
question,
is he is
Mr.
going
President.
To destroy the oil industry. Will you remember that, Texas? Will you remember that, Pennsylvania, Oklahoma?
Vice President Biden, let me give you 10 seconds to respond,
Ohio.
And then I have to get to the final question. Vice President Biden.
Look, we have to move toward a net zero emissions. The first place to do that by the year 2035 is in energy production. By 2050, totally.
All right. One final question.
Is he going to get China to do it?
No, we're finished with this.
Is he going
to
get China to do it?
We have to move on to our final question.
No,
we have to
I'm
move on to
I'm going
to
rejoin Paris Accord and make China abide by what they agreed to.
All right.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
This week's stock performance has been similar to other weeks, influenced by the ebb and flow of news related to stimulus progress. So pretty much no real change there. The Senate failed to pass a much smaller $500 billion package, while House Speaker Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Mnuchin continue their discussions, even here by the end of the week. At one point, Pelosi gave the White House a deadline of Tuesday to get something done before the election. Of course, that came and passed. That day, Senate Leader McConnell said he would bring a bill supported by the president to the floor if it passes the House, but continues to want a deal after the election. Regardless of what little progress was made this week, there's an underlying current here that can be viewed in the 10-year Treasury yield, which has been ticking higher for some time and reached 0.84%, up 17 basis points in the last 30 days, while the 2-year yield remains low at 0.15%, so spreads have widened. The outlook that eventually we'll have stimulus and the likelihood it will be over $2 trillion is helping to push those inflationary fears. The other side effect is cyclical and small cap stocks continue to get a lift on stimulus hopes, even if it appears likely after the elections. As long as there is hope of a bill eventually getting passed, these groups are getting some bullish support. There were a few notable stories this week I wanted to share. The TSA disclosed on Monday that passenger levels exceeded 1 million for the first time since March on airlines. While that's been down 60% from a year ago, it's a huge improvement over the summer, which saw only 507,000 passengers on June 20th. On the same day, Monday, USA Today reported that a study by the Department of Defense showed air on planes is safer than air at home due to new filtration systems and ventilation systems on planes. That doesn't mean, however, that there aren't any risks jumping on public transportation to get to the airport or in the airports themselves, but it may ease traveler anxiety about flying, evidenced by the climbing numbers. The news lifted airline stocks on Monday. On the vaccine front, Moderna said it would have a vaccine by December and Gilead Science had its remdesivir therapy approved by the FDA. On the economic front, continued strength in housing numbers helped overall risk appetites, with housing starts up 1.9% in September and existing sales up 9.4% in September. Initial claims dropped by 55,000 after last week's big surge, and the Conference Board's leading economic indicator increased 0.7% in September. So some good economic news there. And some PMIs did come. I didn't want to go through all those, but it looked like manufacturing ticked up for Europe, the U.S., and overseas in China. But we did see services tick down, obviously, I think probably because of some increase in COVID activity going on. On to earnings. At the 40,000-foot level, there is a large number of reported earnings surprises. So far, 27% of the S&P 500 companies have reported thus far this season, as of Friday. And of those, 84% have reported earnings above estimates, which is a big quarterly win there. Of those that are surprising above estimates, they are doing so by about 17% on average, which is above the five-year 5.6% average, according to FactSet. But despite the surprises, the blended estimate, which includes companies that have currently reported and the estimates we have, it's looking like another quarterly decline in earnings overall by 16.5%. Remember at the beginning of the season, I said that the estimates were for 20%. So overall, we're seeing a decrease in those estimates as companies are reporting and surprising. Now let's highlight a few reports this week. I'd like to start off with Procter & Gamble, which is looking more like a growth stock than a mature consumer staple because of COVID. Before COVID and stockpiling of consumer products, the company would beat earnings by 2 to 5 cents. They beat this quarter's earnings by 21 cents, the largest surprise in 5 years, to a sum total of $1.63 per share. They've almost doubled their earnings and sales guidance for this year due to stockpiling of products, and we still see that taking place here as COVID does increase across the U.S. right now. Netflix missed earnings estimates this earnings season due to a push forward of subscribers. They guided net additions, which for the quarter, they said, we think we'll get to 2.5 million. This came after they gained 10 million in the second quarter. What actually happened is they came below estimates at 2.2 million net additions in subscribers. In addition to that, they've guided that they're only going to get 6 million in the next quarter, which is typically their strongest quarter or one of the strongest of them. Some good news is that they've restarted production on season 4 of Stranger Things, an action film, and season 2 of The Witcher. Competition was a notable topic in the earnings discussion. They talked about the launch of Peacock from Comcast. And of course, there was HBO Max and Disney Plus earlier this year, but they really didn't shy away from that they're happy about the competition. Not to mention, the other addition here is the return of sports programming, which takes away from Netflix. Tesla reported this week, and the focus was mainly on profits since it let out what its deliveries were already for the third quarter, which were up 44%, as they mentioned on October 2nd. So the focus, again, was really on their profitability. Can they maintain their streak? And the company announced its fifth profitable quarter in a row with earnings of 76 cents versus 60 cents, and net income surged about 156% to $874 million in net profit. Profit margins improved but to 23.7%, from 18.7% last quarter. They achieved this by shifting towards lower price models, higher demand for their Model 3 and Y cars this year, despite a decline in vehicle average selling price. Also due to higher production rates and lower manufacturing and operational costs. So I continue to expect more back and forth on stimulus with politicians heading into the election, but I think the most important message is the one given off by the fixed income market, which is basically saying something will likely be done. And that bodes well for net interest margins for banks. And that's it for me this week. More or less of the same probably next week. We'll be talking about the ebb and flow of stimulus progress as well as earnings.
What I learned in the federal government is that most cyber warfare is actually conducted by supercomputers running AI algorithms. In other words, there's nobody sitting at the keyboard. Every target on the internet is a source of either revenue, our intelligence, our data, our customer list, or something of value attacking everything all the time. These aren't people that have to take lunch breaks, that have to take bathroom breaks, that have to sleep at night. They work 24/7, nonstop, 365, and they don't get tired.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com.
Well, it's just 2 weeks away, the presidential election. What will this mean for the market? Will there be a change in policy? And what is the stock market telling us about the outcome? Joining us on the program is John Kosar from Asbury Research. John, I want to start with the recent piece you put out, and let's begin with a couple things that you look at. And number one, your correction protection model as of October 5th is risk on. Tell us about that.
It is. There's two models, and we'll get to both. CPM, the correction protection model, is a model that I built years ago. There are three different components in it, and none of them have to do with price. They're kind of secondary indicators, and they're indicators that I've built over my career. Basically, one of my sons is a quant. I handed him over many indicators that I've built, just kind of custom indicators that I've built over my career. And I said, see if there's a model in here somewhere. And that's where CPM came from. What I was looking for was something that would not be influenced by the herky-jerky S&P 500 the way it is these days. It's up 30 today. It's down 40 tomorrow. It's up 25 the next day. There's a lot of noise in there, and I wanted to kind of get an under the hood look at the market. So yes, the CPM is risk on as of October the 5th, which means the internal conditions of the market as I see them, and the model is back tested to 2011, the internal conditions of the market are conducive to prices going higher, stock market prices, I should say.
Yeah, because you're saying here it's a possibility that we could retest the September highs.
Yes. If these models turn, and the other one's the Asbury 6, and we can talk about that when that one's a little more transparent, and probably it's going to be more understandable for your listeners because these are just six indicators that we have grouped that work well together to indicate the internal strength of the market. But yes, as long as these indicators do not, as long as these models stay on a risk on setting, a status, as improbable as it might be, I think we go retest the highs. And we're looking at some other potential leading indicators of whether that happens or not to biotech is one of those. And we could talk about that a little bit if you want.
Sure. Well, let's go next to your Asbury 6. That's a key model that you developed that you look at, try to gauge how the overall conditions of the market look. Let's talk about that one.
Sure. What I use as a metaphor for Asbury 6, it's like when you're older, as we are now, and you go to the doctor, first thing they do is they take your vitals. They want to get your blood pressure. They usually take a little bit of blood. They want to take your temperature, check your reflexes. That's what the Asbury 6 is for the U.S. stock market, particularly the S&P 500, which is the market as far as we're concerned. There are six indicators there. One of those has to do with price, which is the rate of change in the S&P 500. But the other five are relative performance, stocks versus high yield bonds, investor asset flows, corporate bond spreads, volume, and market breadth. And we use these together. We tested them because there's no indicator that works well all the time. I get that asked all the time, and you probably do too. What's your favorite indicator? Well, there's no indicator that doesn't have an Achilles heel. So we picked six indicators that kind of pick each other up. So they kind of work like a hockey team of six people to kind of keep each other playing the game the right way, I guess you could say. They have been positive since October the 5th, but there's a caveat there. We actually update the Asbury 6 every morning before they open. So I just looked at it 3 hours ago. And of the Asbury 6, three or four of them are on the line. By on the line, I mean it wouldn't take much of an adverse move in the S&P 500 to turn them negative. So these are times where I pay particular attention because that tells me now I've got to watch the market. It either gets traction here and it starts its next leg up, in this case would be to retest the highs, or it's stalled. You know, the patient is showing some symptoms of illness. And in that case, it would mean be careful. So the next thing you do then is you look at the chart and you say, okay, what support level can I attach this instance to where these indicators either have to firm up or we're going to roll over? And what I see right now is basically 3405, 3510 in the S&P 500. That's the 50-day moving average that we've been kind of sitting on now for a week. So that's what I'm saying. Above 3,400, as long as our models stay positive, I think we could take a run at those highs. And it should happen shortly, you know, within the next month or so. We can't hold 3,400 and our models turn, we will go risk off and we will start protecting capital.
So if some of these things start to deteriorate in the Asbury 6, how does that transfer to your correction protection model?
They're different. They're different indicators. It's a good question, and I get it all the time. The CPM is a secret sauce, so to speak, because it's three indicators that I have built over my career. We found out that they work really well together as a model. The CPM, are six rather common indicators. You know, I rattled them off just a minute ago. They tend to work closely with each other. Like they both went to risk off on February 24th. They both went back to risk on April 6th. The difference is there were a couple of more up and down signals in the Asbury 6 from April 6th through the present. So the Asbury 6 tends to be a little bit more sensitive. It was kind of designed that way because if you look at the Asbury 6, the actual model, these six constituents are either red or green. So when I see them all green for 3 or 4 weeks and then they start to turn red, that's my early indication. Even though you might not get a signal in the CPM for another week, the Asbury 6 is telling me the engine is sputtering a little bit. And now I start looking at my holdings and deciding where I want to start taking risk off the table. So it's a little more sensitive.
Now, let's talk about individual sectors. You know, one of the big leaders have been the tech stocks, especially the big five within the S&P, and that's been driving a lot of the market. What about the remaining sectors? You have utilities doing well right now. What does the other sectors look like to you?
The sectors that we've liked lately, I have another model. It's called the SEAF model, S-E-A-F, and it's sector ETF asset flows. So we're looking at the asset flows in the 11 sector spiders, and we're measuring once a week, we find the top two sectors of assets in, percentage change positive for assets in, and the top two sectors for percentage of assets out. And we do that in three different time frames. We do it in a 1 week, a 1 month, and a 3 month time frame. And then we look across and we see, it shows you where the money is coming from, where the money is going in the sector space and where it's coming from. And the ones that have been showing up on this model for a couple of months, first of all, industrials, they started showing up as assets in the middle of summer. And I looked at that and I was like, we're in the middle of a pandemic. It didn't make any rational sense to me that industrials were in favor, but they were. And over the past 3 months, I think the only sector that did better than industrials on both a relative and an outright basis was technology, which we all know. The other one I'm looking at is consumer discretionary. For the past 3-4 weeks, we've seen a rush of assets go into consumer discretionary. It's still showing to stay away from energy, stay away from real estate.
You know, it's interesting. You just mentioned consumer discretionary. You also doing very well as consumer staples. Normally, sometimes you see them going opposite direction, staples being more defensive, consumer discretionary being more economically driven. So what about these two sectors doing well at the same time?
I don't know how to explain it. I have seen it also. I don't spend a lot of time trying to figure out why. I just follow the data. Sometimes we don't get paid on figuring out why a certain market is moving or why two assets are moving together or opposite each other. You know, we get paid on where we buy them and where we sell them. So I don't know if that just is indicative of the overall strength of the consumer through the pandemic. I have seen that, but of those two, the one that has shown up in our model has been the consumer discretionary. That's where you're seeing an unusual push of assets in. And again, this is a more of a recent trend, maybe the past 3 or 4 weeks, but that's the one that has really stuck out to me where it looks like there's some alpha there.
I want to change gears and move over to the bond market. What are you seeing? Interest rates, we've got the 10-year yield backing up. We've got a breakdown of TLT. What do the charts tell you about interest rates?
Interest rates have been something that I haven't watched as closely just because we've been stuck in neutral. I mean, the yield of the 10-year has been stuck in that 65 to 70 basis point range for seemingly months. I think it has been months, you know, since probably the beginning of the summer. You're seeing some breakdowns now. TLT, which I think a lot of people look at as, you know, the surrogate for long-term interest rates in terms of price, that has broken down through its 200-day moving average, actually, just within the past 3 weeks. If you look at the chart, and sometimes simple is better on these, we broke through the 50-day moving average in the middle of August. We went down to the 200-day right around October 6th, bounced right back up to the 50-day, this time as a resistance level, held it, and now we're making fresh lows. That looks like a major bearish trend change, simply stated, just by looking at those two moving averages, the 200 representing the major trend and the 50-day representing the minor. And if you look at rates, looking across my screen today, you've got the yield of the 10-year trading about 84, 85 basis points this morning. The next resistance level, as I recall, is just over 1%. I believe the quarterly moving average in the yield of the 10-year is right around 104, 1.04%. And then after that, you're looking at 130, I think, maybe 135. What it tells me, and again, a lot of this doesn't make sense, so you try not to understand the story sometimes. You just follow the data. But, you know, the bond market, you know, interest rates are firming up a little bit. That suggests to me maybe the market is starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel in terms of COVID. Maybe the exhaustion of the election is starting to subside a little bit, just the constant, you know, every time you turn the TV on, you know, it's politics, politics, politics. But I see it as a good sign. If interest rates are going higher here while we're in the middle of a pandemic, to me, that might be the bond market starting to price in better times ahead economically.
So speaking of bonds, what's your take on the high yield market then?
Well, the high yield market is in a very precarious place, as I see it, as the stock market. You know, the linear correlation between JNK, which is a Spider Barclays high yield bond ETF, that's the one we track. There's a couple of them. The linear correlation between JNK and the S&P 500 is tight and stable for, you know, the entirety of JNK. The two trade alike. So often I look at high yield bonds as sometimes a leading indication of what you might expect for the stock market. very simply again, you know, just for the terms of the interview today, J&K moved above its 200-day moving average middle of July. Really couldn't go anywhere. It backed right up to the 200-day moving average on August 14th, held it, had a rally, couldn't make a new high, tested the 200-day moving average again on September 24th, I'm looking at the chart, obviously, and came right back up to that high, right around 106. So I'm looking at this tight little area in JNK between 106 on the upside and 103 on the downside, which is the 200-day moving average. That's a, you know, the market's coiling there. It's building up energy, tight range for several months. That's where your next move's going to begin. If we crack 103 in JNK, and the other thing I'm looking at in JNK is I'm looking at asset flows there. Asset flows in JNK are starting to deteriorate, meaning there's money coming out of there. If that continues to take place, JNK is probably going to fall down underneath, you know, back off from the 106 area and break 103. If it breaks 103, that's very negative for the stock market. On the other hand, if we can get back above 106 in JNK and start a new trend after this 3 months of coiling, that's very positive for the stock market. So I do watch that every day. I watch the flows every day because oftentimes it's about a step and a half ahead of the stock market.
All right. Well, given what your indicators are saying, it's still a risk-on market despite these little midday fluctuations we've been seeing. So you would stay positively invested?
I would. I mean, obviously, we're at some inflection points here. I am positive as long as we can stay up above 3,400 in the S&P. If we break that, I think we could see 3,200, 3,100 very quickly, 3,100, let's say. So through 3,400 with a downturn in our models, 3,100 in the S&P 500, if we could stay up above 3,400 here, get some traction, keep an eye on biotech, you know, biotech should hold in here too. Then I think before the end of the year, we're going to retest those highs.
All right. Well, listen, John, as we close, if our listeners would like to follow the work that you do at your company, how could they do so, please?
The best way is to visit our website. It's asburyresearch.com and go to the contact tab, which is all the way to the right. Put your name, email address, phone if you like, and there's a little box in there for you to put a sentence or two in there. Just say, we saw John on the Financial Sense show, send some information, and we can send you out a couple of free reports and show you a little bit more about the models we do. And if you're interested, we'd love to talk to you.
All right. Well, listen, John, as always, thanks for coming on the program. Stay safe and all the best.
Same to you. It's nice to talk to you again, Jim.
Presidential primaries do a very good job predicting the outcome in November. That's been true for the last 100 plus years since 1912 when primaries were introduced. For this election, I'm predicting a very decisive, almost landslide victory for Donald Trump.
If you want to listen to this full interview, in addition to our three other interviews that we air each week with some of the best book authors, industry experts, and leading investment strategists from around the globe, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Call Financial Sense Wealth Management to schedule an appointment with a portfolio manager at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, if you're addicted to news, there sure is plenty of it out there today, whether it's political or on the economy. The economy did well in the third quarter, but what about the rest of the year and going forward? Let's find out. Joining me on the program is Danielle DiMartino Booth. And Danielle, yesterday the government announced the budget deficit was $3.1 trillion. They're talking or trying to negotiate a stimulus package in Washington anywhere from $2 trillion plus. So when we take a look at these deficits, I never thought, you know, I thought trillion was a big number. I guess now we're talking multiple trillions. How long could we keep doing this?
Oh, I don't know. You know, I spent 9 years working inside the Federal Reserve. We got used to trillions easily inside.
So what's the old saying? It used to be a billion here, a billion there. You're talking about real money. I guess now we just substitute trillions.
The serious answer is that at some point we do indeed risk having inflation, which has been gone for 40 years. I mean, think about the last year that interest rates were rising was 1981, truly rising in earnest. So it's been 40 years now that we really have dealt with a declining interest rate regime and people increasingly not fearing the specter of inflation because it's such a foreign abstract theory that nobody could actually envision it in practice unless your eyes are open and you can see asset prices running away.
But, you know, when you take a look at what we're trying to do, we're on one hand, we're shutting down businesses. Here in California, restaurants can only operate at a certain percentage. I think it's 25%, or you can have things outdoors. Probably doesn't work that well in New York. And then we're shutting a lot of places down. At the same time, revenues are declining, so we're going to have to fill that gap with some kind of stimulus or something. But it just doesn't seem like this is going to work well in the long term, and we couldn't keep going in this direction in the future.
You know, you're absolutely correct. And a lot of it has to do with the return on investment, right? We all learned about ROI when we went to school, and yet somehow the concept has not filtered through into the Beltway. So we don't get anything for what we're spending. Other countries, with Germany being the best example, other countries, they help out high school graduates who might not be suitable to pursue a four-year degree. They say, I mean, there's a process at upon graduation where they're like, you know what, maybe you're going to make more in life if you go the vocational route. And when there's massive layoffs, you know, it is incumbent upon employers to work with the government, public-private partnerships, if you will, to repurpose employees such that you're not pushing people off to the sidelines that then become effective wards of the state, only capable of taking handouts because they haven't been reskilled and there's no jobs for them in their old set of skills. And by the way, the country's falling apart in terms of infrastructure, and we haven't invested in that either. So those are three different examples of a way that stimulus money could actually produce a return on investment. And yet the only thing that seems to be contemplated inside the Beltway is how to give it away. And that's something that is not tenable long-term because it raises the specter of inflation. If you're not going to get a return on investment, you're going to have to continue stimulating the economy going forward, which is a form of socialism by any other word.
Yeah, it's kind of like the old saying, give a man a fish, you feed him for a day, teach him to fish, basically teach him for life. I want to talk about if we're going to be doing this, and this is an election year, obviously there's two kinds of platforms. You have Trump's plan, you have Biden's plan. Let me ask you this. When Obama ran for president, he talked about raising taxes, but he was smart enough to take a look at the economy. We were coming out of a deep recession, a financial crisis. He did not raise taxes his first term. Biden's talking about raising all kinds of taxes. Is it possible that somebody might say, may not want to do that, given where the economy is with a lot of the shutdowns? Is it possible that we wait?
Well, it's a complicated question to answer because you have to assume, first off, that there's no stimulus spending passed either before the election or during the lame duck session. If that is the case, there will be economic damage inflicted on the economy. There's no two ways about it. If the CARES Act is allowed to expire in December, your unemployment's going to rise appreciably, and there's not going to be any type of a wider safety net to capture these unemployed individuals. Rental evictions will go up. The CDC executive memorandum, that expires on December the 31st. So if theoretically, Congress's first day in office, if there's a blue wave, I mean, how many times have I said if in the last 60 minutes? But if all of these things line up, then there will have been economic damage inflicted on the U.S. economy that will require immediate stimulus spending, or you'll have, well, I mean, I don't have to tell you, you're in California, but you will have a homeless problem that is nationwide in very short order.
And that's why I can't help but think that maybe they go with stimulus, just as Obama did. They passed a $1 trillion stimulus package back then to get the economy going. The Fed kept interest rates at zero. They started QE. We have QE right now. And one just wonders if they just postpone these kind of things. I just couldn't imagine if we don't get a stimulus before the election or the lame duck session in between, and the economy remains weak and in lockdown. If you don't put a stimulus, or if you do stimulus, but at the same time you turn around and tax everything, I'm not sure that's going to work.
That's exactly right. You could end up with stimulus that produces no return on investment and higher taxes. One of my followers on Twitter sent me what maximum tax rates would be under a Biden administration in certain states. And it's mind-boggling. California, 62.6%. New Jersey, 60%. New York State, 58%. New York City, 62%. I mean, these are gigantic numbers. So you'll end up with disruption at a state level. I can't tell you, here in Texas, I see so many California license plates. It's not even funny. And this has been a trend that has been accelerating in recent years because people who live in certain states see the writing on the wall. If I'm somebody who lives in California, and I'm contemplating taking home 33% of my take home, that can't be right. 37%, excuse me. I mean, but when you get into the 30s, it's semantics.
I just don't see how that would work, and things would start shutting down. And it almost reminds me of some of the tax rates that we had in place during World War II, where they got up to 94%. But the government was spending such massive amounts, but they were actually making stuff. You know, it was war materials, tanks, airplanes. We were producing something. But if we go in the opposite direction, where you shut down businesses and just give them a check for not working, I just don't see how that doesn't lead to some kind of financial crisis.
Well, and that again is where the Fed would theoretically play a role. But on the other hand, we've seen so little in the way of an effective, efficacious monetary transmission mechanism to anything besides the stock market thus far. So, you know, the limits, the boundaries of Fed policy are very apparent right now. And we still have bankruptcies rising in the background. So there are enigmas, there are conundrums, whatever you want to call it. But I think that what we're witnessing is again, the limitations of monetary policy and what happens when politicians become overly reliant on the Fed doing all of the monetary and fiscal heavy lifting.
You know, it'd be interesting in the past, at least when I got started in the business, we had a group called the Bond Vigilantes, and they would discipline government anytime their policies veered towards an inflationary front. Do you think we'll ever see those bond vigilantes return again?
Well, that's what I'm referring to. That's exactly what I'm referring to. I'm saying that because things have been the same way for nearly 40 years since 1981, we are expecting that bond vigilantes stay in hibernation where they've been for four decades. I'm suggesting to you that if there's no return on fiscal stimulus spending, that the bond vigilantes will wake up, that we will see inflation, because if we're just going to end up running $5 or $6 trillion deficits every single year, because that's what you're contemplating, right? We're already sitting at three right now, and had the stimulus that was first proposed passed, we would be looking at something more like six. So let's just round it down and call it $5 trillion. If we're going to be looking at $5 trillion of annual stimulus spending because the stimulus spending is not well crafted, that actually gives taxpayers some kind of a return while taxes are rising, how could you not expect to see inflation. How could you not expect to see the Walking Dead bond vigilantes come back to life?
Because if you just look at it economically, if you shut down production or reduce it, or shut down services and reduce it, but then yet give people the money to buy those services and goods that aren't being produced, prices have got to give. And that means higher prices.
It absolutely does. And the greatest fear will be if the bankruptcies continue, if the insolvencies continue, if banks continue to not lend because they're concerned about credit risk, the greater risk might be stagflation.
Kind of brings back the 70s again. I want to talk about one other item, and that's the Justice Department's antitrust suit against Google. There's a lot of talk about going after big tech, whether it's Google, Facebook, Apple. You know, I was reading a book between Apple and Google, they control 98% of all the apps that are out there. So they're sort of the gatekeepers if you want to get an app online. What do you think the implications are for that, especially when you have a sector of the economy, the big five, which have been driving the returns in this market?
Look, I am as red-blooded capitalist as you've ever known. But we have stepped beyond the era of the robber baron in America. And there is something wrong when, I'm not sure if you've seen the Netflix documentary called The Social Dilemma.
Oh, absolutely. That is an eye opener.
It's a complete eye opener. So you should not be in California searching for climate change and have the first search result that comes up be climate change is an existential crisis, and then be in more conservative rural areas of America and have climate change is and the first search result come up say a hoax. That's how powerful these companies have become, but it also shows that they're abusing their duty to provide unvarnished truth. If they're molding search results depending on what your past searches have been and where you are located geographically, and when you use a number like 98%, it's clear that something has run off the rails that is very un-American. Because our thoughts are being shaped by these massively powerful monopolies. And that is when the time, the only thing I would say about the excitement of the headline moment is that it took years and years and years when Microsoft was in the crosshairs. Legislation like this does not happen quickly. And so as exciting as it is to see that there's finally been, you know, a suit filed, I can't tell you how long it will be before we actually see any action on this front.
Well, there seems to be at least some gathering interest in Congress about bringing some of these tech tycoons. I mean, it's just amazing after watching the Netflix how much of what we see, what we read, and how our thoughts are shaped by that are controlled by a handful of companies.
Well, that's exactly right. And even as you say, apps, what we can choose as consumers to put on our personal phones, that universe is controlled. I mean, these are highly un-American developments that have come out of a very small coterie of companies. And I purposely watched the CEOs of many of these companies testify before Congress virtually recently and was dumbfounded at how steeped in denial they appear to be. I mean, obviously they can't come out in front of Congress and say, you know what, you're right. We are the thought control police. We are Big Brother. They can't say it. But I was just astonished at their bravado.
Oh, it's absolutely amazing. I tell this story, Danielle. I was trying to get my hair cut because the places around here are all shut down. Finally found a place that was open, and the owner texted me the address. So I went to put it into my GPS system on Google Maps. And before I could type the full address, including the suite number, it called it up with the suite number. In other words, Google had read that off my texting. I mean, it's almost like Orwell's 1984.
It is. And that is, again, you know, right now I'm looking at something called, I'm asking my IT guru for something called a VPN scrambler. And it's apparently some new gizmo that you can put on your device that scrambles your location from time to time, which messes with the algorithms that are tracking your every move.
Well, I'd love to hear about that. There's a program out there called DuckDuckGo that does not track you, and you can actually install it on your system. So if you're surfing the internet, you don't have Google and the search engines monitoring everywhere you go. It's kind of sad that we have to resort to this. Well, listen, Danielle, as we close, you have a very, very interesting newsletter. Tell people about Quill Research.
Quill Intelligence has a daily product called the Daily Feather. Every trading day of the week, we publish. And we've also got an institutional level of products that involve investment advice, guidance, weekly deep dives, access, et cetera. But I will say the Daily Feather for $50 a month is what I've been told by subscribers. It is shut up, stupid bargain, because we provide so much in-depth analysis on a day-to-day basis that it's some of the best money that you will spend, whether you're interested in just knowing more about finance and economics or whether you want to keep a closer eye on your own portfolio.
All right. Well, listen, Danielle, as always, it's a pleasure having you on the program. All the best.
Same to you. Likewise. Take care.
Welcome, everyone, to this week's Big Picture. Today, we're going to discuss COVID policy and the return of inflation.
If you look at third quarter GDP, it's expected to be in the 20%, maybe even the high as 30%. And a lot of that was because you shut down the entire economy. People weren't allowed to go to work. You weren't allowed to go to the office. You weren't allowed to perform typical duties of your job. Then all of a sudden, when we began to open up as we got to the summer, all of a sudden you had a rush of people going back to work, businesses opening up, even though a lot of them end up, we actually went through several lockdowns. But that surge, along with the stimulus checks, remember, the government spent over $2 trillion in stimulus checks, from PPP to increasing unemployment benefits to the tune of $600 a week plus unemployment benefits. So all of that was flowing through into the economy. So when we say the economy grew at 25-30%, that's like on an annualized basis, which is obviously not going to happen. But the real thing that is coming into question right now, you've had several Fed governors come out this week, Brainard, one of them, saying that without further stimulus, the economy is at risk of another possible recession. Because if you're going to keep your economy locked down, as many states are still doing, you can't lock down an economy, keep people from going to work or opening their businesses, and expect that you're going to see economic growth. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah, that's what J.P. Morgan's chief global strategist had said this week and made quite a bit of headlines talking about how the V-shaped recovery we've seen so far is really going to be slowing down a crawl if we don't open back up. And one of the things that he did say is that so far the recovery has been largely aided by what he referred to as stimulus on steroids, massive amounts of stimulus. As we've discussed in the past, you know, we saw over $2 trillion hit to the economy in light of COVID and the lockdowns that took place. And yet there was about $5 trillion that was thrown into the economy and the markets in light of that. So that's been ample supply. But now at this point, there's a lot of back and forth on the stimulus. Most people think it's going to be happening after the elections. But, you know, until we remove the lockdowns, it seems like there is a need to have more stimulus in the pipeline, because you just can't operate if you know, restaurants and other businesses are at 50% or 25% capacity.
Yeah, I mean, if you tell stores they have to close down, if you tell service industries, I don't care if it's a hair salon, nail salon, dry cleaner, whatever it is, if you tell them you can't open up, or if you do open, you can't operate in the way you do, like for a restaurant. Well, you can't have anybody indoors, but, you know, as long as you're at 25% capacity, you could have people in your parking lot. It just doesn't function that way. You can't take away people's livelihood, their means of supporting their families, and not replace it with something. You just can't run an economy that way. But that's what several of these governors and mayors are attempting to do. And the unfortunate thing, Chris, it's raising huge amounts of debt as governments have to finance this. The government we spent, about $3 trillion of stimulus. They're working on another $2 to $3 trillion stimulus following the last one. And depending on the outcome of the election, it could be as high as $3 or $4 trillion of stimulus. I mean, the budget deficit, we just reported the government's fiscal year ends in September. The budget deficit was $3.1 trillion. That's the highest it's ever been since 1919, when we were just finishing or completing World War I. It's the highest since 1939, when we were in the midst of a Great Depression, and we're not too much further from as high as it got during the middle of World War II. And so, it's amazing. We were at a little over $20 trillion when Trump came to office. Chris, we're now approaching $30 trillion, and next year's budget deficit could be $4 to $5 trillion.
We've been producing some videos on our website every week. If any of you haven't had a chance to see those, I would definitely encourage you to go to financialsense.com, and you can see them published right on our homepage or on the video page. And one thing that Chris Poplava showed in recent weeks was you can look at a chart of the twin deficits. That's the budget deficit and the trade deficit. And if you look at that overlaid next to the dollar, that is pointing towards a pretty significant decline in the dollar. If, like you say, debt's going to keep going higher, deficits are going to keep going higher, which most people assume that's basically baked in the cake, then that is going to be putting pressure on the dollar, wouldn't you say?
It's going to be putting pressure on the dollar. It's going to be putting pressure on interest rates, and it's going to be putting pressure on inflation, all of that. You know, it was interesting. The Wall Street Journal did an article, I think it came out on Tuesday, and it was how the southern states, which did not go as deep into lockdowns, came out of their lockdowns much faster and remained open. Their economies are now recovering. The unemployment rate is lower in these southern states. Economic growth is picking up faster there because they're not in this lockdown mode. And in fact, they did a study of a number of people in California who actually left the state and are now, they're in the hospitality industry, and they're now getting jobs in the South. So the southern economy is recovering because you're not going through lockdowns. What I found was interesting is how we have progressed with COVID from the opening. You remember, Chris, when it first came out, everything was about washing your hands and wearing gloves. And it was thought that masks didn't help. You weren't supposed to use them. In fact, they encouraged you not to buy them because there was a shortage of masks for the medical profession. Well, then that eventually changed, and you're supposed to wear a mask. Now it's almost mandatory everywhere you go. In fact, it's you get ostracized if you don't. Try walking into a restaurant or any place. The ones that always crack me up, Chris, is when you're driving in the car and you see people wearing masks inside their car. I look at that and say, what are you doing? Or you see people jogging on bicycle paths and places like that wearing masks. I mean, it's kind of silly. But what was interesting, nonetheless, was how they were reporting how these different economies were reacting to COVID. A lot of it depended on the policies that was implemented by the governors of the state, and the southern states have done the best.
Yeah, well, it's funny, you're talking about how Californians and others are moving to a lot of these Midwestern states. That's something we've been talking about for years, of course. And this has obviously been accelerated dramatically in light of COVID and also in light of a lot of the unrest that we see in many cities around the U.S. But it was just this week, Washington Post published an article, fascinating article, talking about how real estate in Montana is just booming right now. And realtors there can't even keep up with the demand. It's blowing up. And a lot of these people, particularly from San Francisco and LA, They're not even going out to Montana. They're not even visiting the places. They may have been there, you know, maybe Yellowstone or out in that area once or twice, maybe never at all, but they just see a house on Zillow or wherever it is, and then they're calling, they're purchasing them without even visiting. It's just a digital walkthrough on FaceTime, essentially. So it's just amazing how many people are fleeing the urban areas to buy places, like you say, in the South, in Texas, in other parts of the Midwestern corridor, all the way up to Montana.
We've been talking about, since the beginning of COVID, how that was basically accelerating things that were in place prior to the breakout of the pandemic. And one of them, Chris, is migration. In fact, they just there was a report out last week. I mean, California is losing taxpayers and businesses left and right because the state is so crazy. So people are moving out of heavily regulated, heavy lockdown states where you have a lot of rioting in the cities. So California, we're losing people out of California, New York, Illinois, even in Oregon and Washington now, given the events that we've seen transpire over the last couple months. But I want to move on to this issue on the deficit, because remember, the government's fiscal year begins October 1st. So if we look at the fiscal deficit for 2020, which just ended in September, remember, October, November, January, February, and March, we had basically half the year where the economy was in a very, very strong economic growth phase. Unemployment was down to 3.5%. And in just 6 months, given the fact that without COVID, we were due to hit $1 trillion this year as a government budget deficit, and that's without the pandemic. Throw in the drop in tax revenues, the stimulus spending, and the deficit was $3.1 trillion. Chris, they're estimating next year the deficit's going to be anywhere from $4 to $5 trillion. I mean, we're going to be well north of $30 trillion as a country. And that's, you just keep your fingers crossed that interest rates don't rise precipitously as they're starting to do now, because one of the ways that's been so easy on the government is our massive amount of debt, but we're looking at 0% interest rates, T-bills at next to nothing. So the government is able to finance a larger deficit because the cost of financing that deficit is low. But, you know, this will not last forever. I mean, if you take a look at what could end all of this, and this is what we're looking for in 2021, I think the big thing the market is not anticipating is a change in Fed policy. In other words, the Fed would be forced to start raising interest rates because we're anticipating a major return of inflation that we should see start picking up next year.
So, Jim, we talked about how, you know, with the federal deficit exploding, you said it could be as high as $5 or $6 trillion next year. That's just astounding. I don't think we've ever seen numbers that high before. And if that's the case, you know, that means it's going to be putting pressure on the dollar. So that, I would assume, is another part of this piece when we have to think about why we should expect inflation to be rising going forward if the dollar's also going to be declining.
Well, it's a number of things. The first one is just basic economics. If you take the amount of goods and services that we produce in the economy and you reduce that by 30 to 40% because of lockdowns or because the government is putting small businesses out of business, and then at the same time, you give people the money to spend on those goods and services where the supply is less, well, it's basic economics, Chris. The price is going to rise. It's like anything else. You see this, you know, when you see weather-related events, you see the cost of lumber go up. Or, for example, you could have a situation where there's some kind of natural catastrophe. You know, the water disappears off the shelves in grocery stores. And then when you had earlier in the year, when there was a shortage of food, of protein, you saw the price of beef escalate. So you can't reduce the amount of services that you produce and restrict it, and you can't reduce manufacturing supply, but at the same time give people the same amount of money to buy those goods and services, there's only one thing that's going to happen. What's going to drive that is going to be higher prices. And that's how the economy works. And so it's going to be that combination will be one on the inflationary front. The second one is the U.S. imports a lot of its goods and services into this country. The twin deficits that you were mentioning that my son Chris pointed out on its impact on the dollar. So what does that mean? If the dollar goes down, it means the things that we import in this country. I mean, ever look at the label of anything you buy, whether you're buying it on Amazon or in the store? Where is it made? It's made overseas. So if the dollar goes down, it means those goods, when we import them into this country, are going to cost more. At the same time, you're restricting supply, which is also going to drive it. So that's why we expect that's the one thing the market isn't really geared for right now, which is inflation.
You know, Jim, when you're talking about increasing the cost of goods going up and supply and demand, I mean, this Thanksgiving, I think we're going to see a real pop in the cost of not only heat lamps, but also porta potties. Because, I mean, there's some rules coming down the pike. You got to think about, people are going to be scrambling for these goods.
Yeah, I mean, you're sharing. If you don't live in California, just know that California kind of sets the pace for the rest of the country. I mean, some of the things the governor is doing in this state, is he's acting more like a tyrant. And I kid you not, this is a mandate coming down from our governor on Thanksgiving. If you are a family, it's mandated that you cannot have more than two family members over for Thanksgiving. So in my case, I have three sons. I would have to pick which two would be able to come over to our house for Thanksgiving. That's number one. Rule number two, you cannot eat your dinner indoors. It must be outdoors. Number three, people can be allowed to go in the house to use the restroom only if it is immediately sanitized. And I kid you not, folks, these are the rules coming down in California. I mean, some of this stuff, Chris, is what we're seeing is so much more political science. I mean, you know, the governor of Illinois mandating that you could be a family of four or five living together in a home, but if you decide to go on a boat, only two of you would be allowed on the boat at any one time, no matter the size of the boat. Or you have, for example, in our state of California, the governor will not allow Disneyland to open, but in Florida, Disney World is open and it's flourishing. So much of this, the policies, there's no national cohesiveness to any of the economic policies, and a lot of these policies are really destroying the economy. California's budget deficit, we've gone from a surplus to a huge negative. Well, duh. What do you expect when you shut down about 40% of your economy? You tell restaurants they can't operate at more than 25% capacity. You close down gyms. You close down hair salons, nail places, all service sectors. You close it down. You're hemorrhaging tax revenues. And what does California do? They're going to raise the top income tax rate from 13.3%, which is the highest in the country, to 16.8%. They're passing a bill on imposing a wealth tax, including a wealth tax on a private held business. They are removing the caps on commercial property taxes, which is the worst thing you can do when commercial property is hurting now. Office space is hurting, retail space is hurting, we're raising taxes. And then on top of that, as companies start moving to Zoom for communication and to work, beginning next month, California is putting in a communication tax. So it's one of the reasons why, Chris, that you've been hearing more and more, probably the greatest exodus you're going to see from these high tax states. It was already occurring before COVID. It's accelerating at three times the pace. I have a client who's looking at moving to the Las Vegas Henderson area. And they were looking at two track developments in those areas. They were supposed to remain open for about 2 years. They opened up. Chris, they sold out within the first year. All the developments. Same thing is occurring in Reno. Toll Brothers has 16 projects. They can't build them fast enough, and they're being sold. And of course, if you live in California and you go anyplace else, everything looks like a steal compared to the prices that you're paying here. But it's funny because I'm hearing the same thing about Arizona. Arizona prices have been driven up, a lot of that coming from California. Now Arizonans are moving to Texas. So there's a massive migration that's going on right now that is accelerating as a result of COVID. And a lot of the things that we've seen with the riots and the looting that you've seen in a lot of these major cities.
And as we've discussed in the past, of course, also the fact that you can work from anywhere in the days of COVID now. I mean, remote working and all the technology and tools that are available to engage with clients or your coworkers through Zoom, which, you know, you and I and we're doing here with our own work. I mean, this has just become the reality now of today's world. The longer we persist in this state, the more of an inertia we build in this type of dynamic. You know, I mean, that's another thing. People are like, hey, I'm at home all day. I'm working from home. And I'm in a city where I'm paying massive amounts of money, either just for rent or for living in a city, cost of living is high. Why don't I just move to Montana, right? Why don't I move to, I don't know, Idaho or Texas, you know, where I can dramatically lower my cost of living? So this calculation is making obvious economic financial sense for so many people and is just accelerating this trend that we've been discussing and which our clients have been doing. Some of our own employees have been doing and taking advantage of now. So this is a trend that is well underway. So Jim, given some of these events and what we've discussed so far, what are some of the impacts that you're looking at that this will have on the markets in the long run?
Well, I mean, if we take a look at the recovery that began in March, Chris, a lot of this has been liquidity driven. It certainly wasn't based on economic numbers. The economy was contracting in the second quarter. It's based on Fed injections. Right now, the Fed is injecting or buying $120 billion of bonds a month to keep interest rates as low as they are. But eventually, as I said, the government policy is going to bring back inflation. You can't reduce the supply of goods and services and print money to get people to buy the same goods and services without driving prices. That's number one. So there's an inflationary element coming in. Number two, our massive trade deficit and our massive budget deficit is going to drive the dollar lower, which means the cost of goods that we import in this country are going to get higher. And sooner or later, the bond market is going to be looking at this. And then the Fed's credibility is going to come at stake. So the Fed could be forced at some point next year, if we start getting up to 3, 4, and 5% inflation rates, nothing hyperinflationary, but nonetheless inflationary, the Fed could lose its credibility unless it is forced to act. And if it is forced to act by raising interest rates and doing so aggressively, you can kiss goodbye to the bull market in stocks.
And folks, remember, if you live here in California like we do, Emperor Newsom has very clearly declared that, number one, gatherings that include more than three households are prohibited. This includes everyone present, even the hosts and the guests. The host should collect the names of all attendees and contact information. And number three, this is very important, all gatherings must be held outside, rain or snow. You know, you're talking about end of November. So even if it's cold, you must be holding Thanksgiving outside. That turkey, you better eat it quick because it's probably going to cool off very quickly. And attendees may go inside to use the restrooms as long as the restrooms are frequently sanitized. So keep those things in mind when you're celebrating Thanksgiving this year.
I know. It's one of the reasons we're looking at porta potties as an investment.
And heat lamps. Don't forget the heat lamps.
Yeah, and the heat lamps. No, but seriously, the one thing that we have not had, you would have to go back probably to the summer of 2008 when you had oil prices at 150 and the CPI, the annual inflation rate, was at 5%. And of course, the Fed had aggressively raised interest rates, which eventually led to the financial crisis. But the markets have been under this assumption that we're in this disinflationary environment, and that's the one element that people aren't expecting. So, you know, we see an inflationary decade in the 20s, and the result of that, we see another commodity bull market. In other words, anything that comes out of the ground, we're extremely bullish on precious metals, copper, and just everything from fertilizer. So anything that is tangible, we're going to move towards that kind of transition from a paper market to a market of things. So very much like what you saw in the 00 decade, what did well? Oil did well, gold did well, base metals did well, real estate did well. In other words, hard assets. So it's going to be a hard asset environment in this decade, in my opinion.
Well, Jim, with that said, how can our listeners get in contact with Financial Sense Wealth Management if they'd like to take advantage of any of the services that we offer, either for individuals, corporations, our 401k servicing program, and some of our other services that we offer here?
A number of ways. You can contact us on our website and send us an email, or you can call us at 888-486-3939, and we would be glad to talk to you. We have a number of advisors with a lot of specialties in corporate cash management, 401k programs. And here's one that a lot of owners of businesses don't realize, the liability that they have with their own 401k programs and being in non-compliance with ERISA. So, you know, something very important that you should make sure that you're up to date on your ERISA laws if you have a company 401k program. In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until we talk again, stay safe and have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.